today I'm here with Thor from Casual Corporation. Thor, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background? I guess you've been at Zynga and a bunch of other interesting companies.
Sure. About 12 years of startups under my belt, starting with mobile gaming back in 2001, when it was a very, very different kind of thing than it is now. But wound up at Zynga as an early guy there, setting up their first remote studio on the East Coast, and went through some pretty crazy growth there, as you can imagine, and left a couple of years ago and set up a few companies. A couple of them were social gaming companies, and one was a healthcare company that ended up doing fairly well down in D.C. And it's still operating with about 80 people down there. And out of that experience, that collection of experiences, realized that there's effectively a better way to do this, and decided to set up Casual Corp to help other people create companies, but to really create them with them. So what we do is we take...
Well, before we go into that, because we've got plenty of time, we'll certainly cover that in a lot of detail. I'm actually just curious on a general question. Your name is Thor Ernstsson, but you have an American accent. I mean, are you Swedish or something?
I'm Icelandic.
Oh, really? Were you born in Iceland?
Yeah, born and raised in Iceland, yeah.
When did you move to the States?
In 2000.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like your English is better than mine.
I hear an accent when I speak, but...
Right, okay. And so then you worked in New York for a while and then in D.C.?
No, I moved to Huntsville, Alabama, as you do.
Yeah, that's the center of internet innovation.
Yeah, exactly. Iceland, from rural Iceland to Huntsville, Alabama. And then the natural next step was Toronto.
Right.
It's obviously a longer story there, but I moved to the States. Couldn't get a job in anything normal because I couldn't get a security clearance. And in Huntsville, pretty much every technology job requires a security clearance. So that didn't mean I couldn't be a contractor. So I set up a company. I set up a company to do some DoD and NASA subcontracting, and hired a few friends to work on that with me, and that eventually became a startup consultancy where we did both business and technology work with startups.
So you came from Iceland to the U.S. knowing that you wanted to build an internet-type company?
No, I just came here to work for a year, and I was going to go back and go to school in Iceland, go to grad school. And I had no preset agenda beyond that, not realizing also that I had to have a work permit, which I didn't have. So there was a bit tricky getting here and staying, but you know, afterwards I realized that from doing a few startups that that's where my passion was.
So and how long were you at Zynga?
I was at Zynga from 2009 to 2010.
And I mean, one of the things that I've never talked to anyone that has been at Zynga, but I've read about them a lot online, and they're famous and infamous at the same time. And one of the things that has been really interesting to me that I've heard about Zynga is the fact that the company has not only applying a lot of metrics to its games, but it's also applying those to management. And it sounds like that hasn't always worked out as well as they'd hoped.
I haven't actually heard that, and that might be the case now, but when we were growing, like doubling quarter over quarter, it was hard to even figure out what metrics to look at. But they did do a good job of managing, I mean, relatively speaking, of managing that kind of hypergrowth. And the point about the games being managed with metrics is true to a degree that most people outside of it don't understand. Because at the core of it, Zynga is really an analytics and metrics company.
Right.
Like it's not, games are just the medium that we use to sort of engage people.
So what kind of stuff did you work on at Zynga?
So I was a lead architect, sometimes called studio CTO of Zynga East, which was the studio behind Frontierville. Mm-hmm. So originally we set out to build a certain kind of game, and then over a 9-month period, it morphed into what became Frontierville and had a lot of game mechanics in there that weren't in any other game. And then within weeks, every social game had them copied.
Right.
So what we did there was pretty groundbreaking in terms of the genre of casual games, but it was taking traditional game mechanics and sort of porting them over and seeing what works and what didn't work. So it was a lot of experimentation, a lot of new things, a lot of creative things. And let's see, I guess what we did then impacted most of the other games at Zynga as well.
So you were looking at traditional games and seeing if you could convert them into a social environment?
No. So we took social games like Farmville, and we looked at what was working in other games, like quests and narrative and some sort of progression through the game and resources and sort of a spreadsheet-style game, but applied to more of a Farmville type of game, and introduced all of that to it. So we were the first social game, really, with quests, at least at scale, that had some sort of characters and a progression that they went through and a storyline.
Mm.
So what we were building is effectively a vehicle for episodic content.
Mm-hmm.
And that vehicle was a game.
Right.
So
yeah, I mean, when Farmville started out, I decided, you know, Fred Wilson was posting about it on his blog, and I decided I wanted to learn it. So I played Farmville fairly intensively, and I got hooked. I mean, I actually really did, and I played it to a pretty fair level. One of the things I guess I noticed with that, and then I haven't gotten into any games since then, they do seem to have a similar structure. So I guess, is that what you're describing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Is that what the games are all about is really a matter of psychology. And the psychology is that of getting invested in a process that is very simple up front, but then you start building an artificial value system around it of things that are now yours, where before, from the outside, if somebody looks at, I don't know, a late stage player in a game like Farmville or even World of Warcraft, even more serious games, and they truly just don't get what motivates the person because they haven't gone through the process, whereas the player sees it rather as one small investment at a time, and you build up towards something where now you're hugely invested in a game or a game environment where you're going to keep doing that. And you're going to keep playing it and keep nurturing it because you don't want to lose out on what you have. And it's just a psychological principle of sunk costs and a few other things that we use to build on to go into it. And like now, what we realized is that applies well beyond just gaming. And that you can build entire products and entire companies around those products based on those same principles.
Well, one of the principles that I guess that I noticed is that these games would have multiple types of currency. You'd have free coins and then extra coins that you could get, but they were scarce, and so you'd have to buy those, and that's where the monetization would come in, and then a third one as well. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that. That seems to be a pretty central concept across a lot of these games now.
Sure. So when I mentioned we introduced resources, that's really what started that. Except, well, there's always been a premium currency and a game currency. And the reason for that is there had to be some natural way to monetize the games. And that monetization came in the form of an energy mechanic or a premium currency or a handful of other things. And the premium currency would be used to basically accelerate the game or to buy certain items that otherwise wouldn't be available. And the game currency fairly well stops mattering at a certain point.
Right.
That's a way for you to get involved in the game, make it easy, and make it like easy to demonstrate value to a beginner user. But then over time, it starts this artificial value system that I mentioned kicks in. So now you care about progress or about items or about some sort of social standing within your peer group. Of other players.
It's addictive stuff. I mean, there's one other game of this type that I played, and I vowed I wasn't going to put any money into it. Like in Farmville, I think I spent $100 on it because I was just like, I'm just going to buy my way through this. And, you know, right. It was pretty interesting. But I played Dragon Vale, which I have you heard of that on the iPhone?
I haven't played it, but yeah.
I mean, no one's even heard of these guys, and they just come out of nowhere. And I've vowed to myself, I'm like, I am not going to put any money into this, you know, like, because I don't normally spend any money on this sort of stuff anyway. And yep. after I'd been playing it for about a week, I was like, my God, I really want to buy stuff in here. I mean, that second currency that matters is really important, and it had me really hooked. I think I did actually spend a couple of dollars on it, and I got value from it too because it was impeding the overall progress of the game, and I was that hooked right. on it that I really wanted it.
That's exactly it. That's it.
And so was that one of the concepts that you guys noticed from one set of games to others, and then that was one of the central concepts that kind of coalesced?
Yeah, to a degree, but that predated what we were doing. That was something that was fairly well established, that you could build limiting factors into games and then let people pay to bypass those limiting factors.
So what were the kinds of things then that you were crossbreeding across these games?
So one of the things that we introduced, for example, was needing your friends in order to go through the game, where it wasn't just about them helping, it was about introducing friend gating, so that to build a building, you would need your friends to send you something, or you need to hire them to man your building or something like that. And what that generates is social pressure, not just for engagement, but re-engagement. So then now, if I don't have a lot of friends that are playing the game and I invite you and know you in real life, I might actually call you or email you or text you or whatever to go back to the game to accept my invite to staff my building. So now you're going to be using the game because I'm asking you to directly as your friend, whereas what's also happening is that you're going back to the game, and while you're there, you're going to play a little bit longer and you're going to play a bit more. So that's one of the deepest forms of engagement, is when you can drive actual social pressure for re-engagement, because now people are coming back to a product, and it doesn't have to be just games. Because of other people they know that are there. So LinkedIn endorsements are a good extension of that into non-gaming products.
Where, so like, hey, will you accept my ad on LinkedIn?
Yeah, but the endorsements themselves where
oh,
once endorsed by somebody, there's a slight reciprocal pressure to go, have to go and maybe endorse them or look at them. But it doesn't feel like LinkedIn is sending you the notification. It feels like that person is sending it to you.
Right.
Even though obviously it's just outbound message from LinkedIn.
One of the interesting things from Zynga, I guess, is the amount of testing that went on with different things that you could buy, and how heavily all of that was tested. Were you involved in those sorts of things?
Yeah. So we had a small army of product managers tweaking almost every part of the game. And there, it's much more about, again, the metrics and analytics behind onboarding and viral touch points and monetization points and things like that, where we want to make sure that people can go through the games as easily as well as possible by how we want them to, but then also introduce these gates at the right times. When is the first time you should run out of energy? What should the prompts be? How much should the first products on the first screen cost versus how quickly should they go up? So those kinds of things were all tweaked, and best practice is shared across the games, both at Zynga, but then also sort of elsewhere, not just in the industry in general. But obviously the advantage that Zynga had was a much bigger data set than anybody else.
Was that a big advantage?
Huge. Because it's not just data, it's actual users as well. I haven't looked at this recently, but it was something like, the last time I did an update, I think it was 320 million monthly users.
So obviously the users can then be cross-promoted across other games, but aside from those sorts of aspects, what are the advantages of having lots of data?
You can make decisions based on actual data instead of just gut feel.
Right.
So if you launch an experiment, which doesn't require necessarily a code push, it's just something you can do in real time, launch an experiment to change the price of something, and within an hour you might have 10 million data points.
Yeah, right.
And that's significant. So now you can roll it back, or you can push it even further, and you can do a lot of interesting things that, because the iteration cycle is so much less than if you have to wait for the data to come in.
So you mentioned you went from Zynga then off to a healthcare company.
Yep.
Or a startup. How does this, these would seem like different fields. How do these relate?
Very, very similar to the transition from Iceland to Alabama. The healthcare company originally was started around the concept of applying Zynga-style mechanics, not games, but these social pressures and these types of incentives and triggers, and applying that to the context of health. We didn't know exactly how we were going to do that. So first thing, it was, I guess, four of us up front, or initially, and then some with a background in e-commerce and a couple with really great connections into healthcare. And the basic premise was taking an outbound marketing platform, applying game mechanics to it, and applying it in a healthcare context. So it's fairly simple, but then we realized that the need for what we were talking about, at least, because there wasn't a product yet, was so great in the healthcare industry overall that we decided to basically take a bigger stab at it and ended up raising a ton of money and hiring a bunch of people to execute against it. But at the core of it, it was really about taking these casual engagement mechanics and figuring out how to make a difference in healthcare. So we built a social health platform around basically contextualized and recommended content, communities, and challenges that were applied in a healthcare setting through health insurance companies. So we could give you a sort of a web type of experience, but based on your actual health data. And that was the.
What's some examples that, like, how that would work?
You would go onto a website through that may have been like promoted to you through your health insurance company, but not necessarily. And you authenticate, and with that, we have your health records, and then we can drive recommended content and communities so that you can engage with other people based on health context and health situation. Just behaviors that people are doing today anyway, just in a fairly untrusted context of just the internet.
Right.
So we're trying to make that, just improve that situation overall. But then also we had challenges and wellness platforms and a bunch of other stuff that was integrated with it. And then ultimately sold the product to a few people. I'm not quite sure what's public yet or not, but a very large health insurance companies. Huh. And then over time morphed into more of a health sort of health tech company, and I moved to New York to set up Casual Corp.
So I guess are you allowed to say the name of the healthcare company that you founded?
Oh, sure. It was Audax Health.
AUDAX?
Yeah, AUDAX, yeah. And it was technically it was founded before I joined, but there was only three people there.
So then, so you sold that, and I mean that came together well, and now you're basically building an incubator here in New York.
Yeah, it's not quite an incubator, but yeah. And also, we sold the product. We didn't sell the company. The company is still operating with about, I think, 80 people down in D.C.
All right.
So Casual Corp, again, is not an incubator. It's not an accelerator. It's not really. There isn't really a good label for it. The closest model is basically a private equity model for how companies are created, but it's not – even that doesn't work because we're not putting a few hundred million dollars to work. So what we do is we target – it starts with a founder, and we find founders that are domain experts at something, and we look at both the market opportunity for what they're going to do. We give them a process to be able to tie everything together – and then all the tools to execute. So then those tools include product development, marketing, branding, and stuff like that. And then we set them up with our network and our environment for growth. And that environment includes other founders, includes VCs and investors, and then also sort of executives from large companies that are our clients as well. So one part of it is this new business creation part, and the other part is working with Fortune 500s or Fortune 100s even in an innovation consulting setting where we come in and help them think like a startup and help them create processes to drive culture change and drive new product development initiatives and stuff like that. And it's very it varies from client to client. But what that also gives our new companies and our founders the ability to do is talk to C-level people at Fortune 100 companies, which normally they wouldn't have any access to.
So you're doing consulting through this and looking to help founders who want to build out businesses. Does that sound correct?
Yeah, but so even the consulting part is a little bit different because it's applying the exact same process. So we're applying the Casual Corp process both in a startup setting and in a corporate setting.
Mm. That makes sense. Sure. And so actually, I looked and I noticed tomorrow. In fact, you guys are running a Skillshare class. Yep. And I looked through it because it's what some of the things you're talking about are interesting. And I guess what I'm curious is, I started to get a decent foundation in Lean. How much is what you're teaching Lean, and how much of it goes beyond that?
So imagine a Lean process, but with a purpose, is a good way to sum it up if you're familiar with the Lean principles. Because Lean Startup teaches you to notice when you're not doing the right thing, but it doesn't really tell you what to do next. So in our case, what you start with instead of just a hypothesis or instead of just a test, what you start with is an aspirational vision. And it's something you can never achieve, but that guides all your experiments and that guides all the things you try to do. So each pivot is really just the next hypothesis or the next experiment to prove or disprove what you have until you get sufficient conviction one way or the other that you can truly execute against what you're doing or not. And we have a sort of a roadmap to be able to articulate that very clearly, that then maps to how you talk about your company, how you execute. So it's more, the foundation of it is much more Steve Blank's customer development than it is Lean, but you know, they're obviously all very similar.
I mean, why do that rather than just build another startup yourself?
Because there's this fairly massive inefficiency that I've lived through multiple times, and I see this way as a way to make a much bigger impact. Where there's hundreds, if not thousands, of people just here in New York that are great for startups, but are locked out of the startup ecosystem because they're not 22, they're 42, and they're a domain expert at something, so they've worked at it for a long time. Maybe they want to start a company, but they both don't know how to do it and are maybe a bit more risk averse than your normal founder. So those people are the ones that we say we can build companies around by coupling them with the right ingredients from the startup ecosystem to really make something unique.
Fair enough. Do you want to talk about some of the companies you've been working with?
Sure. We're doing a psychiatric assessment company out of D.C. There's actually some articles coming about that today. And the founder is a psychiatrist, a world expert on mood disorders. And he's ironically fairly entrepreneurial, but still a great candidate. So we went through an abbreviated version of our fellowship program. And our fellowship program is what we use to teach people this process. We're about to launch that company called Good Measure.
And so, I mean, that's pretty interesting to me. I'm interested in all that kind of stuff. Can you talk about, I mean, it would seem, I guess I'm having a hard time understanding how Zynga-style virality and testing can apply to a psychiatric company. I would love to understand that.
Yeah. So it's really the process around customer validation.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do is, for example, generally when somebody says they're going to launch a company, it's going to do X, Y, and Z. It's going to be a social community around something, and people are going to discover new people, they're going to find new content, and they're going to manage their existing networks or something like that. And what we do before the product exists is we have the founders identify a customer segment. And the customer segment at first is something that's large enough to build build a company around, but still has to be addressable. And all they do is they create hypotheses around what values that customer segment would get out of the product. And they leave it at that. There's no product development at that point. Then they identify a subsection of that customer segment that are their early adopters. And those are the people that would love the product. And the metaphor we always use is what these people need to do when you tell them about what you're building or what you're about to build. They need to drop whatever they're doing and hug you because you made such an impact in their lives, even if the product doesn't exist yet. And the thing is that if you can't come up with a value statement that's at least perceived to be important enough to drive some sort of behavior change or drive some sort of investment from your target audience, when they're the ones that should love this, then either you don't understand your audience or your values proposition well enough, and you're building something that people most likely won't care about. So the Zynga part of it really is about identifying those leading indicators before the product exists, but then building out the products as structured experiments So the first product might be a summary newsletter email blast or something like that, when really what you're building is a social network over time, but you're validating one step at a time that what you think you're doing is actually what's going on.
Or what they need, basically, what they care about.
Yeah, what the early adopters care about. And it's okay if you can't build a business around the early adopters, but you got to solve somebody's problems to that degree, because otherwise you're not going to be able to scale it out.
I mean, and that's actually how both Craigslist and AngelList got started. They were both email lists.
There you go. and there's countless examples of something like that, where you just do one thing and you do it really well. And often, though, what companies, the process companies go through to get there isn't that. They start by doing a lot of things, and then the founders realize that they can't execute against 15 things really well and choose to pick one based on whatever criteria they have. And as long as they focus on doing a good job of that, then they can have something real. And then, because once you really dig in and once you get users that are really passionate about your product, they're highly engaged, then you can scale that out. You can add additional features to get a broader user base, but you have to start with the core users. You can't start by building something everybody likes a little bit. You've got to build something that a few people love.
So in the psychiatry case, what were the users and what did they love?
The users are physicians, the primary care physicians, and the current hypothesis is that they're rural ones that are that don't have any psychiatric expertise around them. Are the ones that love it the most, because the company exists around the problem of lack of psychiatric expertise in general. Physicians and a lot of healthcare professionals don't know how to treat behavioral health problems, don't even know how to diagnose them. So the first product, even though it's a much bigger target, but the first product, all it is a digitized screen that physicians can roll out and actually bill for. So they'll get paid to administer a screen for behavioral health problems, and in the same process, or from really not doing anything new other than just that screen, they provide better care. Because if they identify behavioral health risk factors as a part of somebody's treatment or that would impact somebody's treatment regimen, then at the end of the day, they're going to be more adherent and they're going to be more compliant to their program, to their main physician. And then they can obviously drive that to a psychiatrist as well if they need those problems. So it's a small problem, but in healthcare, even small problems turn out to be pretty big and pretty complex. So what I'm talking about is even more important to do well in regulated industries, because there often isn't a healthy market for innovation. If you introduce a new product just because it's the best product, it doesn't mean it's going to get adopted, for a variety of reasons. So you have to do it in a much more structured way, in a much more focused way. And the customer validation part is even more important, because your customers often are not the end users.
Interesting. And so this is his current hypothesis, which he's working on engaging with and seeing the level of engagement that he can get. We presume then that the psychiatrists that he's working with are in rural areas, want to come up and hug him because it's so important. And perhaps he's starting with a newsletter right now and is then going to grow that into something bigger.
Not quite. So in that case, it's more just a digitized screen. And initially it's going to be in a tablet format, but then it's going to become basically a software as a service deployment model. But the process we went through to get there was basically focusing on the physician's needs and what it takes to drive them to action. And we learned some things in that process that were maybe obvious in retrospect, but one of them being that the quality of care wasn't something we could lead with. Even if that happens as a byproduct of what the service does, that wasn't going to be enough to compel physicians to action. So it's also a question of positioning, because really what we're getting at is, what is the most compelling value proposition behind the product? Mm-hmm. And then that impacts how you talk about it, how you market it, how you distribute it, and then all the viral loops that go with it. Because if I don't incentivize people to adopt the product properly, then no matter how good it is, it's going to be a much more difficult proposition to get them to use it widely.
So, I mean, in the case of mental health care, like how do you instill viral loops? That would seem to be something, if mental health care is something that people aren't going to talk about as much.
That's a good point, but it's, so the initial product doesn't require them because it's not a consumer-to-consumer product, but as an example of an effective viral loop around behavioral health or really any kind of health is is having some sort of caregiver, some sort of person that you trust to monitor your adherence. So if you have to fill out a survey, for example, every month, nobody wants to do that. But if you also appoint somebody else to help you out with that, and you both get notified a few days before the deadline, you don't want to be the person that doesn't do it, especially if you know that your doctor or your or some sort of caregiver or some sort of person will see that you didn't do it. So there's social pressure for you to go and fill it out.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you're not really sharing any data, all you're really seeing is a green dot or a red dot. Those types of things are pretty compelling when it comes to behavior change. But you have to do it appropriately, and there isn't a silver bullet here. You just have to try a lot of things and test them and see what works and what doesn't.
And that's really interesting. And so I'm curious then, in terms of the stuff that you've worked on, it sounds like your experience is more viral. Like, I mean, are you working with things like media buying and driving traffic as well?
We use services for that. So we don't do that directly, but we have companies that we work with for that.
So you would outsource someone to run pay-per-click campaigns and that kind of stuff?
Absolutely, because that's not really core to our value. Ours is much more product design, product development, team building, those types of things. They go into the company, not necessarily driving adoption. Because the product itself to drive adoption is everything's on a case-by-case basis, and the leadership team of the company really has to own that.
Right. What are some of the other companies you're working with?
We're creating an education company called Kenna, and it's around a couple of people that are in our fellowship program. And there it's effectively... So Kenna as a company exists to create these types of social products in EdTech, starting with independent and corporate learners. And they're identifying the first few markets by going through the exact same process. And then over time it becomes, again, something bigger. The first product is called Challenge Hall, and it's a social learning platform with basically rapid-fire instruction and assessment. And then social challenges around that so that you can compare all kinds of things, but progress really and mastery of learning with other people that are in your peer group or in your perceived peer group. And we're experimenting with a few different ways to drive social engagement there. And there's a lot of education, just one of those areas like healthcare where there's no lack of opportunity, but each one comes with unique challenges. And often it has, again, nothing to do with the product, but rather how to get it to market.
But I guess since at the core base you're starting with a product that you've cut down to example, to 100 people that want to hug you because they like it so much, that makes everything else a lot easier.
That's exactly right.
Have you heard of Max Levchin?
Yep. It's fairly similar to... his concept. And we have
Max Levchin, he's the co-founder, one of the co-founders of PayPal. And so he's just started something, but he's talking about hard, valuable, and fun. And it seems like what Max is talking about is, in fact, the opposite of lean, that he wants to sit and work on hard problems and not sit and try and pivot around on finding the easiest path forward.
Yes and no. So it is similar, though. So Casual Corp and HVF are similar in the way that we tackle these problems, because what they do is they apply a common technology toolkit to hard problems, and the things that we do, what we're talking about here, are actually hard problems in the end. Solving all matters related to lack of psychiatric expertise is an unbelievably hard problem.
Hmm.
But we don't start with that because you can't boil the ocean. Instead, we start with an addressable market and then a hypothesis of some sort of how you can drive engagement in a small market. Because if you can't do that, the hard problem almost doesn't matter. But it's very, very similar.
So how does someone, when someone comes and wants to work with you, like what sort of terms, like what kind of offer do you make to them? You know, how do the deals work out?
Sure. So it's on a very much on a case by case basis. When we started, there were standard terms for all the concepts and all the companies, and then we realized that just wasn't going to work because people come in with different backgrounds, with different risk tolerances and different needs. So as it is right now, we look at every concept that we actively work on as an investment. So there isn't a standard answer, but we end up, when it's all said and done, we end up with a minority ownership of whatever company comes out, and we basically have the role of angel investors, even though there's a few other things that go into it where there's on an ongoing basis, we'll be there in an advisory capacity or something like that. But the goal is to build these out as independent companies as soon as possible.
I mean, is your model similar to Y Combinator? You just adjust it per guys that come along?
Not quite, because Y Combinator is there's really very little involvement beyond the network after their program, and they take in, I think the summer class last year was something like 85 people,
right,
for 85 companies. And we wanted to do 6 or 7 at a time, but it looks like we can do 2 or 3 that are sort of ours and maybe 2 or 3 that are external. So the model, the numbers are very different, but the outcome of it, we look at as being a largely de-risked startup because you're, as soon as it's an independent company, it has a market, it has revenue, it has clients.
Which is the single biggest risk in getting anything going.
Right, exactly.
And I guess what the stats are that 9 out of 10 new businesses fail.
Right.
No, I mean, I looked at what Max Levchin's talking about with hard, valuable, and fun, and I actually wonder if he's maybe pushing back against lean in a way that he shouldn't, and that you should be working through the marketplace on the path that's the easiest to get through. He seems to be avoiding that, and it sounds to me like your approach is the smarter one.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I respect what he's doing because it's something that, again, it's similar enough, and there's a handful of companies that are approaching it that way, but I'd say his is the closest parallel to what we do, even though it sounds different. But it's because they have the experience of having built out fairly large companies before, and being able to just focus on solving interesting technology problems.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, we're solving problems around user behaviors and user expectations, and you can't do that in a vacuum. You can solve technology problem just sort of by yourself or with a small team. But building, at least in our model, figuring out how to apply these engagement mechanics and new user behaviors to existing problems or existing industries or existing markets, you just can't do in the same way. You can't sit back and pretend you have all the answers. And that's one of the hardest things, actually, for our founders to go to come to grips with, is that we challenge almost every assumption they make about things that they think they know very well.
What's some examples?
So like the one I gave earlier about physicians being most interested in quality of care to their patients when in reality there's so many alternatives for them to give better quality of care, you have to stand over the noise somehow. So what we learned is that we only got their attention as soon as we put first that this helps them make more money at the end of the day.
Hmm.
So things like that happen through informal focus groups, user testings, formal focus groups, and other sort of tools that we have while the company's in exploration mode. But then as soon as possible, we want to validate those assumptions with real products.
Right.
And even if they're not fully fleshed real products, they still would be. There would be some data and some metrics behind all those hypotheses. So, and then ironically, when we, on the corporate side, so the corporate innovation side, we're helping a handful of companies build processes and build new concepts internally and in certain cases with large companies even reinvent their business or reinvent their, who they are. And when we go through this process there, they all assume that their clients care about the same things they do and that the client's behaviors are exactly what they expect them to be, when in reality, that's simply not true. Very few people make a purchase decision based on just what one company tells them. They first consult with their friends and experts or salespeople or whoever, and at that point, the company's completely out of it. So instead of figuring out just how to improve the sales process or get more products out there, we help them build products around how to engage users in what they're doing already, mm-hmm. but in the context of their brand. So it's those conversations are often pretty interesting because at first people are adamant about how their customers or their users are a certain way, and then once they realize that their basic assumptions often don't even hold up, that it becomes a new world to them, and it's always really interesting to watch that transformation.
When I went through the lean machine, I'd been aware of these concepts for a while. I've been looking at parts of them. I've already internalized a lot of them through doing a lot of direct response, and I mean we do a lot of testing, and we're pretty efficient at that. But I found it fascinating because I went through that process as well, and some of my concepts about the market were just wildly wrong, and it was just right. Fascinating to see that happen. It was humbling.
There you go. That's good. You lived it firsthand.
Oh yeah. No, I have the lean religion now. Like you know, there's a lot in there, and it's some of it's obvious, but some of it isn't, and it's weeding out a lot of problems.
That's it. That's exactly it. And it's trying to. So, I really don't like how the startup world has glorified failure, because the purpose is never failure. Failure has to be acceptable as an outcome, but the purpose is learning. The purpose is going through and pushing your hypotheses further and further and further until you have validated something, and or not, and it's okay to invalidate it, but it's not failure. And one of the things where that causes a problem for us in how the startup world has glorified it is when we deal with big companies, again, Fortune 100s, Fortune 20 companies, and they research something like Lean Startup and they see failure, fail fast, fail, fail, fail all over the place. No corporate executive is going to embrace that. Hmm. And it's just such a cultural change that, you know, maybe it's okay to be deliberately over the top in certain ways, but now it's trickling down into founders as well that are glorifying failure. And again, it's the end results are probably okay, but there's sort of an interesting take on it that a lot of people have, where it's almost like the goal is failure.
Well, I would say that's dumb.
I agree.
Okay. We got a few minutes left. Have you got some other things that you want that we haven't covered that you'd like to talk about?
No, maybe do a quick plug for our fellowship program.
Sure, tell me about it.
Which is basically taking this whole process that we apply both in corporate settings but also for startups and teaching it to aspirational entrepreneurs. It's very much on a case-by-case basis as well. We ran it as a couple of classes, got really great results, but we realized that we needed to be pay sort of closer attention to individual needs, that it isn't something we can do en masse, but it is something that has a lot of value to people as they go through it on the same path, sort of same path. And we're always open to talking to aspirational entrepreneurs or new founders, and especially if they are serial entrepreneurs, because those people ironically get the most value out of this process because they recognize the lessons because they've already lived them.
So, they've gone through the pain.
Yeah, exactly. So when we give them a sort of a process to what to do next, instead of just explaining how they fucked up the first time, often that's really, really valuable to them.
And how does the fellowship program work? Like, how much does it cost, or how does someone get involved?
So as it is right now, it's with a minimum of a 20-hour, but preferably a full time, a 20-hour week, but preferably a full-time commitment. And it doesn't cost anything, because the goal is to go through this so that we can build a business together. So there's a fairly selective process to get in. And then once you are, though, you're working with the Casual Corp team and then other people that are going through this or have gone through this on building a business. It's sort of like an entrepreneur in residence. And then the goal for us is simply to do something together to get sufficient validation and conviction behind the concept, and then we back it.
I noticed on your website, do you give technology platform or other stuff as well? Like, what other?
Yeah, so we have a tech platform around most of the types of problems that we work on, where we have an existing, it's both a platform but also sort of set of libraries around rapid development and prototyping that we can deploy things very, very quickly. And those things aren't just prototypes, they're actually scalable. They're scalable products because they're built on many of the same principles that I've built stuff on before. And it comes with a few restrictions, but not that many. So if the problem is something that involves user interaction and gathering time series user data, it lends itself very naturally to our platform. And then you can tie in all kinds of things like triggers and actions and rewards and emails and credit card transactions and stuff like that to it, so that you're really designing a product using our own internal Casual Corp metaphors for how to describe them, which lend themselves directly to our entire model of escalating engagement loops and how to think about these types of products and how they can be disruptive over time. So it ties it all together into a very concrete technology platform. But I think that'd be a subject for another conversation of how that whole thing works.
Sure. And I mean, just in the last question, I'm curious about this. Are you more of a technology guy or a business guy? Like, which side do you fall on?
I'm not sure I fall on a certain side. I'm equally comfortable on both. I do a lot. So my background is in both as well. So both and neither.
Right. Jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah,
that can be a good way to be. Yeah. All right. Well, Phil, thank you very much for the interview. That was great.
Yeah, good talking, and look forward to catching up soon.